Would you give your mum, dad, aunt or that uncle who hugged your partner a little too long free access to your phone?
Oh, no!
Oh, my God, it's a really long video. Ew!
In Dave's brand new YouTube original, Get Off My Phone, we've got six comedians to give their phones over to a relative with total freedom to read messages, DMs, photos and browser history.
Where's your search history?
Sorry?
What to do, tips for relief.
The rules are simple. Their relative can read anything they want and even make calls from the comedian's phone.
What is this?
What is... I don't want this one.
That looks really bad.
Starring Tanya Moore, Anya Magliano, Finlay Christie, Travis J with his mum Angie Lamar, Hayley Morris, Grace Campbell and dad Alistair Campbell.
Slightly sexually compromising
people. Divulging their deepest digital secrets.
What the hell is happening?
Get Off My Phone, a Dave YouTube original. Available now on Dave's YouTube channel.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to Conversations Against Living Miserably, a podcast.
One of those things.
Ah, yes.
My mum described it for us. It's like the radio, isn't it?
Hello, and welcome to Conversations Against Living Miserably, a podcast where we try to find solace in a world where our brains are usually against us. Each week we chat to a different guest about how they try and live their life without misery, but we try and do it with a little bit of laughter, because otherwise that sounds like a pretty gloomy idea for a podcast.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Dave, the TV channel, and Calm, the campaign against living miserably. And as usual, your hosts are Aaron Gillis, which is me, and...
Lauren Patterson, which is me. I'm the girl one.
Oh, keeping that one. Morning. Terribly sorry about the week off last week. Hope you didn't miss us too much. Basically, Lauren was away in Australia doing comedy things and being a famous comedian, and I just overslept, to be honest. I was going to come up with an elaborate excuse as to why I didn't publish the podcast, but no, sleep, tired, always tired. Also, a quick apology about the sound quality of this intro. I'm in the middle of a field, and trying my best Adam Buxton impression. Frankly, just a little bit lost, to be honest. Anyway, this week's guest is Jack Rook. Jack is a comedian, campaigner and writer who has explored subjects such as grief, loss, anxiety and suicide in his Edinburgh shows and in his BBC Three documentary series Happy Man, which is absolutely excellent, and you can watch it on iPlayer now. This week we speak to Jack about being a mental health campaigner, how the conversations around mental health are changing, and horrible experiences with therapists. You've got to have a bit of a laugh with that sort of thing, haven't you? Just a content warning for this episode as well. We do discuss suicide a little bit, so if that's something that you're not feeling like you want to listen to right now, or just want to kind of come back to it later, then just put us on pause and come back. But do listen to it, because it's a good conversation. Also, if you could, what's the words? Like and subscribe, rate and review, all of that sort of thing. That'd be amazing. It helps us get up the iTunes charts, and the more people that listen, the more money that goes to Calm, because all of the ad money we make from this goes directly to Calm. So by listening, you're donating to charity. So you've done your good deed for the day. Woo! It's good, isn't it? Anyway, I'm going to try and find my way out of this field. So here is our conversation with Jack.
Welcome to the studio, Jack Rock.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, our pleasure entirely. Would you like to ask the first question again? I feel like...
We got like 8 episodes in with Aaron always asking the first question. I think I've now made him self-conscious.
Yeah, definitely. Goddamn fucking patriarchy. Yeah. I was taking over from the get-go.
So, when was the last time that you felt calm?
The last time I felt calm was before I... Oh, God. Oh, no. My answer sounds like a plug, but it's not a plug. For heaven's sake. The last time I felt calm was before I started writing a book. So I'm writing a book at the moment, and as soon as you know that you've got to deliver like 80 to 100,000 words, it doesn't matter if I'd be on like an island beach in Mauritius with like hot oiled like Greek men fanning me with palm leaves, I'm still shitting it pretty much at a constant rate. So yeah, that was the last time I felt calm, probably before, so maybe this time last year. And actually, do you know what? This time last year was after the end of a really horrible sort of period of anxiety that I'd had. So basically, it's bizarre because I've done a lot of stuff for Calm, and I'm sort of a long-term ambassador. I started ambassadoring for them in like 2011.
Yeah.
I was like one of the original Power Rangers. That's how I feel. I was the red one. And so obviously, like, I've been very kind of like ingrained in the kind of mental health, I suppose, conversation, so to put it, for the last sort of 5-6 years. But when people used to talk about anxiety to me, I used to be like, oh, you're just a bit nervous. Mm-hmm. Oh, you just had a bad day.
Yep.
Have you had a bad month? You're a bit worried.
Didn't sleep well.
Yeah. Are you a worrier? Drink some water. Do you know what you should do? You should go for a long walk. It really helps. Yeah. And then, like, I got struck with it very, very badly from about November of 2017 until about April of last year, 2018. And it was like a crab that just slowly sort of sinked into my brain. And it's really hard to get out. And I was like, wow, no, this is what anxiety is. It's completely and utterly irrational. I felt a little bit kind of bad for sort of diminishing anxiety, sort of like depression's little brother. Because I could understand depression, but anxiety, I was like, what are you really that worried about? Mm-hmm. And then I had it so bad to the point where I wasn't really working and I stayed at home with my mum. I'm quite a big lad, shall we say. And I, for the first time in my life, even though like I've been through quite a lot of severe grief and bereavement and hassle in my time, the first time in my life I've actually had no appetite. Mm-hmm. Like when people would be like, oh yeah, my dad died, I just lost like 3 stone instantly, I'd be like, fuck off. Fuck you. And then I got anxiety and I was like, this is such an effective diet. I can't eat anything and I can't sleep and I'm just sort of like walking and running and jogging into walls.
Yeah, completely.
And then it started to lift around sort of March, April of last year. And yeah, and then I felt really, really calm for about 3 weeks. It was amazing. I'm sort of walking around and all my friends did the sort of cliche thing of being like, you look so great, you seem so happy, well done. And then I signed a book deal. And that's my first world problem.
Did you naturally come out of that anxiety low, or was that something you worked towards, or is it just something that naturally lifted?
Do you know what? I mean, it was a weird anxiety. I speak about it a lot, actually, in the book, but it was kind of triggered by... all of 2017 actually speaking so much about mental health and so much about suicide. And I made a BBC Three documentary all about it. And then I did an Edinburgh Fringe show all about sort of losing a close friend to suicide. And just speaking about suicide every day for a month is not right. Especially when there's like no real aftercare put in place or any like psychotherapist or anything. Like I just felt like a whole year... I felt like I'd spent a year being sort of poster child for like friendly, warm chats about suicide. And then by the end of it, I was like, God, I'd quite like to kill myself. And it was dreadful. I mean, really, really dreadful. And I think the way I sort of worked out of it was to actually take a bit of a step back from that and to sort of generally like try to... I'd done the sort of like... There was sort of one incident that kind of really badly triggered it where I got in trouble for doing something wrong. And I'm not going to divulge quite what that thing was.
Ooh, the mystery. The mystery.
I did something not lawfully wrong, but civilly wrong.
Okay.
Where the civil courts could have... I did something naughty. Let's say it was like a driving fine. It's not a driving fine, but it's like that bad. Mm-hmm. But like actually, in the grand scheme of things, not that bad.
Yeah.
And I just went mad. I was like, well, this has happened, and now my life's over, and I'm an absolute wreck and a mess, and what's the point of everything? Mm-hmm. And actually, I think I very slowly came out of it just by sort of allowing the irrational, an irrational voice took over, and it was just allowing that irrational voice to gradually get less prominence and platform in my brain, and having a lot of really good friends who were like, I suppose, really literate in kind of caring about people's well-being and mental health, whatever, but we're also quite hardline, like, this is fucking stupid, come on now. Mm-hmm. And I think I've always been quite a champion of a bit of a balance of that, because I think there's sometimes I speak to people who kind of talk about mental health and they talk about it in such an oversensitive sort of clinical soft way. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, every now and then you need someone to be like, cheer the fuck up, like pull your socks up, do something about mm-hmm. this. And that doesn't mean that they're being insensitive or trivialising what you're going through.
It's a bit of tough love, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah,
it just means they love you. That's
yeah,
it.
Completely.
Yeah.
And also, like, fear and love operate on such a, like, same axis almost. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, if somebody you really love is telling you to come the fuck on, it's probably because they're as frustrated and lost as you are. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I think I was really lucky. I just had really great friends around me who sort of helped me kick it out of it. And then... yeah, I mean, also, you can't really mope around being like, oh, I'm so useless, when, like, someone's going, we'd like you to write a book.
Yeah.
Or we'd like you to write a book. Which one do you want to go for? Oh, like, so, yeah, definitely think that helped. And, yeah, that was probably the last time I was calm. So that was quite a long-winded way of saying April 2018.
Absolutely love it. So now when you kind of, because you still do talk about mental health and,
yeah.
and suicide and all these issues, and you do amazing work with Calm, do you now make sure that you don't let it become all-encompassing to, or a detriment to your own self? Because
yeah.
for me, I found that out the hard way as well, when I was just talking about all these subjects that were very heavy, and I just didn't look after myself whilst I was talking about it.
Yeah.
But everyone else in front of me, to my own detriment, I got really ill. And but so what do you do nowadays?
Well, I think it's about, for me personally, sort of not like... it's a really bizarre thing, because I think that mental health right now has hit its like full peak saturation in terms of like the mainstream conversation.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was a bit sort of, I get, and I think the thing that I find annoying, having, you know, and this is not me being like, I cared about mental health first. It's not me saying that, but like, 7-8 years ago, when Calm was based in a tiny office that genuinely stunk like feet, like it smelt like the worst case of athlete's foot you could ever imagine, and it was just five people in there trying very hard to get like the tabloid press to care that men were killing themselves at a disparate rate to women, and no one did care for a long time. Like that conversation was really important to have. It was important to tell men to open up, and it was important to try and encourage talking. And then as that time's gone on, the mental health conversation has progressed, which is brilliant, but it's also been really co-opted by a lot of corporations and a lot of media outlets and a lot of places that don't really give a fucking shit about people's mental health, mm-hmm. but are using that as a vehicle to essentially profit off of other people's trauma,
yeah.
and profit off of like, Hey, we're Dugga 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 brand, and we're really friendly and we care about you, but our staff are all fucking miserable as sin, and our boss has been paid a bonus and no one really gives a fuck, but look at this amazing campaign we're doing.
Yeah. Like,
and I've seen that so... I mean, I've seen it... I almost feel like I've seen it nearly 100 times now. It's like the last 2 years, it's become really quite a bad, you know, epidemic of, I think, exploitation. And I definitely... played a part in that at some point, of not necessarily like being the exploiter, but being exploited and being part of those sort of like quite faux campaigns, really. And I think that kind of chiseled me down a bit, because I was a bit like, there were some things I made where it was very interesting how people would really want me speaking about my friend Ollie, and they would So for example, I would always describe my mate Ollie as a close friend. We went to university together. I know him for like 2-3 years. He was brilliant. He was about 6 years older than me. Gave me a lot of brilliant advice, but I'd never describe him as my best mate. Like, I have another best mate. And also, Ollie's best mates aren't, like, do you know what I mean? But any time I spoke about him, it'd be like, Jack lost his best friend.
Right, yeah.
To digga digga, and it would be so, like, they'd just make this really sort of concerted effort to, like, really dramatise and what I call sort of X-Factor sob story.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, filming this one bit in a thing that I made that I'm generally actually quite proud of. This is different to some other projects, but it was like filming sort of at Ollie's grave and sort of almost being like, oh my God, I'm being sort of pressured to cry here because they need some emotion on camera. And me being like, this is wrong. Like, like anyway, and I think sort of that kind of, I don't know, emotion porn angle that's become apparent.
Fetishizing?
Fetishizing.
We get there in the end.
What's the shies bit? Yeah, in a way. And I think, and so that was frustrating. So me having a sort of time of talking about it, now anytime I'm going to speak about it, it's going to be, you know, a podcast like this, which I know Karma involved in, and I know that people are clued up to it. Mm. And it isn't just like, hey, we're insert brand name here. I'm conscious of not saying brands because I don't want to get sued. So yeah, so essentially I just used to get very frustrated and I got very angry by the fact that I would just constantly read people either in their books or in magazines or in newspapers say this sort of like, you know, thankfully I was really lucky that I could see a psychotherapist and not everyone can afford it. And then full stop at the end of that sentence. And I'd be like, that's completely fair enough and amazing you're aware that you're lucky, but then that full stop isn't there. Like, you have to then try and do as much as you can to help the people who can't afford the, you know, £100 Harley Street therapy session.
Indeed.
And I just feel like the prominent voices in that mental health conversation never got past that. They were like, I'm actually fine now, this is my sob story, this is how hard it was for me, and look at me, I'm great, and I'm not going to do fucking diddly squat to help anyone who can't have the same journey as me. And that was really frustrating because I just thought, you're not really enabling like the average normal human being who's gonna access that content, so to speak, to actually access any help.
Yeah, because it's so difficult because these problems are so individualistic and we all go through our own different things with them. Mm. And when I wrote my book, I was very much along the same thing. I'd read a bunch of books which were basically misery porn.
Yeah.
Of someone going through their journey saying, I was fixed this way, this way, this way. It'll probably work for you. If you're poor, you're probably fucked. And at the end, I'm great. And I got to the end of all these books, I was like, I feel empty. I'm like, I feel like I haven't learned anything. There's nothing I can take away from this book that's going to help me in my day-to-day life. And sharing stories and making sure that so many people have access to these different things is one of the great things about Twitter. I know like Twitter's a bit of a shit show at the moment, but people can, of all walks of life, can tell their stories, and making sure that people have access to so many different ways of getting help.
Completely.
Like when you said the therapy thing, I couldn't afford therapy when I was younger. I had to go on the fucking waiting list for the NHS and took about half a year. And then the only one they could get me to was 3 hours from my house. So it was a whole day off work I had to take. So I was losing money to go get therapy. And it's kind of like, no one ever tells you about that.
And it isn't like a comfortable thing to do.
No,
is it,
it
like...
isn't.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're quite good, and you say that kind of like we've reached this peak of where the conversation is at the moment, and where do we go next?
Yeah.
And it's such a beautiful question to ask, because whilst the conversation is there now, we are hopefully getting more comfortable talking about these things in a public forum. We're all here sat talking on the podcast, so we're obviously quite comfortable expressing these things, but a lot of people aren't. Mm. What do you think those next steps are?
I think those next steps are things like addressing the fact that the next step for me, so I'm going to talk about it, I'll answer in a dual way.
Oh, lovely.
So
love it.
For me personally, as somebody talking about it, it would be nice to be able to say, hey, I've lost this friend and this was shit and this is what he was like and this is our relationship. It's important to open up. And then for that conversation, the next part needs to be like, and the reason I believe that he's not here is because there was no early intervention service. They didn't spot his symptoms sort of quick enough in his sort of deterioration in his mood and his thoughts and where he was going. Like, what I have found up until now is that everyone's totally fine with me kind of like legacizing my mate, so to speak, but won't ever let me say, oh, and this is the reason why he's in that grave. Yeah. And they will never, and that isn't a case of being like, fuck the Tories or fuck this. Like, it's not really that political in that sort of way. I think people worry that all of a sudden someone's just going to go on like some sort of Tory bashing thing. Yeah. That's never been really my agenda. Because I'm a massive... But it's just a shame. So for me, the future is to be able to pair that story with something that has a solution attached to it, which is like reforming a lot of those sort of access to service type points. So I did an Edinburgh show in 2017 called Happy Hour, where I essentially was trying to sort of tell the sort of truth about how, like, I feel like my mate's mental health deteriorated when he moved back home. So he moved from London, which generally all the mental health trusts in London are at real, like, breaking point, but are functioning at least. And there's money in there. And he moved from there to, like, Bognor Regis in a seaside town that was one of the worst rated, like, mental health trusts associated to it. And I'm like, well, you know, we don't necessarily have as much of, like, a north-south divide anymore in England, so to speak, but we definitely got like a rural divide. Like, if you're from a seaside town that's got no injection of like care or like help to it, or if you're from like a place that's just really run down, whether that's inner city or in like, you know, 20 miles away from the nearest town, like, you're gonna feel really isolated.
Yeah.
And it is a bit of a postcode lottery, so it'd be good to address that. I'm going to sort of get quite specific action.
Oh, I love it. No,
God,
really?
I sound like a politician, don't I? It's horrible. But I think it's just generally getting people to understand why the services aren't in good nick, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, particularly for me, what upsets me is that, like, I look at Ollie and I think he could have been so much better had his issues essentially been dealt with earlier on in his life.
Yeah.
And then I look at the state of like child and adolescent mental health services, which is known as CAMHS. And if you were to really look at the funding into them, I mean, it's diabolical. Like, children's mental health services are in a total state of like disrepair, with just generally like incredible staff force leaving because they can't cope with it anymore. That's where I worry, because really, I'm not so much worried about like the 40-year-old man who's worked in the city all of his life having a crisis. It's like the 11-year-old kid who like lives in the seaside town that might be gay or might be this or might be is struggling with completely no access to anything. And they don't have an access to, like, you know, that kind of trendy best-selling book that someone's written about, like, the time they had depression and whatever. Like, and that worries me, that we kind of ignore them in a way, and because we don't understand it. So that's why I'd like the conversation to go so that people are aware that actually the generation coming up all beneath us are really having a hard time.
Yeah, indeed.
Like, they really can't access the services because it really is genuinely being pulled.
Yeah.
And yeah, so, and then I think another thing is just generally I have to sort of like feel a bit, basically it really pisses me off. Mm-hmm. And what annoys me about it is it sort of turns me from like sort of comedy writer who loves writing jokes and actually quite likes being silly to all of a sudden this like fucking vapid, like angry, like spitting hell at everyone because we just like, because I think I get annoyed about the fakery of it, and then I get annoyed about the removal of the important stuff, and then I also get annoyed because like, because people do care. On the whole, you could give people all of these facts and it wouldn't all of a sudden sway a political election. It's not going to make everyone care. It's not party political situation here, because my dad died under a whole different government and they were still shit then. Like, you know, it's not as on the nose as that. But the annoying thing is it's like people would be able to grasp this. It's really not like scary political clause act inquiry type stuff. It's like just basic, you know, knowledge and awareness. And I just find it, I get them frustrated at whoever the gatekeepers are,
yeah,
at not allowing people to know that. And then I have to sort of calm down and sort of sit with my mum and eat a chocolate cake and just watch like, you know, that, oh, my favourite programme to watch when I'm a bit pissed off is Long Lost Family.
Oh,
you know, the
yes,
one where Davina McCall reunites abandoned children with their parents.
I love that.
Fucking, that's what makes me happy again. I'm like, thank God.
That's there my is calm good in the place. World.
But yeah, I feel, even now I feel like I've just scared you both.
No.
Not at all. It's a wonderful quote though, isn't it? If you're not angry, you're not paying attention. Mm-hmm.
I don't ever want to kind of trivialise someone sort of sharing their story or whatever, but that's kind of why I did get annoyed about like the pop star who's making the mental health documentary getting it wrong, because I'm like, you have got a huge platform to educate people, and if you're already going to get it wrong before you've even put the thing that you're making out, then you know that's a disservice to a wider conversation that mm-hmm. needs as much sort of like, you know, education and people being clued up as possible on how long that journey can take. And also the fact that, like, you know, I'm conscious to say this because of whoever's listening, because therapy is a very good thing always, but like, I've been to see maybe two or three therapists over like my adult life and I've never really got on with them. And that is not to say that I won't try and find another one, because I do think it takes a while. It takes a while to find that right person or that right method of therapy. You know, imagine how hard it is on the NHS when you've got to wait however many weeks to just get one appointment. And if that person's wrong or they don't get it, or also like, there's also so many different parts of mental health that are affected by, look, I don't want to go into like the mad fucking density of identity politics because it drives me fucking up the wall anyway. But like, I would probably really love to at some time speak to like another gay person as a psychotherapist to mm-hmm. be like, well, this is bits of it shit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, and that's a quite different sort of identity set of experiences that like, I would perhaps maybe look, I've never had a gay psychotherapist. It could be like,
if you're listening,
I don't think I'd have a gay. I think I'd go for a lesbian. I trust him more than gay. But yeah, like I kind of, you know, I've never had that experience before, in the same way that I know a lot of my friends who, you know, from different minority groups much prefer to speak to someone mm-hmm. who like comes from the same culture, the same
exactly.
race or whatever.
Because, and it's probably the same for young people as well. I think there's this sort of stereotype that therapists are like old, stuffy, middle-class
yeah.
people. And I personally would feel so much more comfortable talking to someone my age or someone like,
yeah.
I need like a young, trendy, like, drunken anti-therapist.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I need. Like,
you need Fiona Shaw's character in Fleabag yeah. now. It's just like, have you got any friends? No. Right, so you're just having a lot of sex. Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. And I'd definitely encourage anyone who's thinking about that, like, just bear in mind that the first therapist you meet, you might not get on with at all. Mm. The first therapist I met is quite sort of like a story that has been like two or three of my stuff, is like this bereavement counsellor I met when I was 15, just after my dad had died, she came round to our house, and she was this woman in her 70s who was Canadian, who just basically sort of sat with me and my mum, opposite me and my mum in our living room, and was just like, oh, no. And like looking at photos of my dad around the living room, me and my mum just being like, what the fuck is going on? And she just kept on saying like questions to my mum, like, what do you see yourself doing now? Where would you like to be? And she's, and my mum was definitely in the sort of mood of like, well, I'm a fucking husband back then.
Is that an option?
And like, what a stupid question. She'd say things like, and what did, you know, what did Lawrence love about you, Josephine? And my mum would just, my mum would want to be like, well, my tits. like, and it's so weird. It was someone like a real stranger, especially when it's like a session at your house. And then she kept on asking these weird questions, and she kept on wriggling in our armchair, and we were like, what is wrong with this woman? Like, she's just very bizarre. And then all of a sudden, she just farted really, really powerfully, like really loudly. And me and my mum just sort of looked at each other, and we were like, did that just happen? Did she just fart in our counselling session? And then you noticed that it clear. And this is honestly, my mum actually tells this story in this Radio 4 show. I get her to do it because people never believe it. And my mum can't lie. Uh-huh. So this is how everyone knows it's the truth. But she, this council woman just started like, kind of like sort of shaking and really wriggling. And then we realised she'd obviously followed through.
Oh, no.
And because the smell hit. And once the smell hit, I was like, this is despicable. And also,
have
like,
some decorum. We are grieving here.
Yeah, essentially. And she left about 5 minutes after and was like, I'll email you in the week. We'll do another session. And I sent her an email back being like, we're okay, thanks.
Yeah, please don't come around and shit in our house again.
Please do not shit on our armchair again. We've been through enough. But yeah, that's my mum's, the one and only time my mum's ever sought out therapy. Mm-hmm. And she's just like, I just don't think it's for me.
It's quite like, a bad experience.
They all shit themselves.
They're not all 70 Canadian with bad bowels. Like, we're okay.
Maybe she just came in to use the toilet and then ended up being sort of, I guess I'm a, like that guy who turned up accidentally at the BBC for an interview. Yeah. Maybe she was just like, oh, I only wanted a shit, but.
Her eyes just popping out. I mean, but in a weird way, the way that my mum tells it in my show, or my old show, was that she was like, I loved it because it's the first time we just really, really laughed at someone. She was like, it really did me good just to have like
tension.
A proper like laugh at this woman at her expense. I was like, okay, mum, good for you. I'm glad. It would have been nice if she'd have helped us, but she did in a way.
Because I always thought that like, therapy's like dating, and it takes you a couple of times to find someone that you are more than happy to be around for an hour a week.
Yeah, completely.
But for me, I've like one of the first therapists I went to see after the end of our session, he looked down at his sheet of paper, looked back at me, and just said, "If I was you, I'd be depressed as well." And I just sat there, I didn't know what to say, so I got up and went to leave and shook his hand, and I stood at the bus stop and I lit a cigarette. I just burst out laughing. I didn't know how to handle that. That was like the fucking stupidest thing a therapist could ever say to you.
That is, I was just like, I think almost the worst thing.
Yeah, I was just kind of like, how did that happen? And it's just like absolutely bonkers.
Was he trying to be empathetic?
I think he was trying to be nice, but it just came out as the worst thing anyone's ever said.
I went to a therapist who told me about another comedian who they were being the therapist of. Oh. And I was like, well, you're obviously shit, aren't you? You've broke the first rule of your job.
The first rule of therapy club.
I've got to do a gig with that person in 2 weeks' time. Don't tell me that you're having sessions with them as well.
And here we are today.
Lauren, you're on the waiting list, babe. You wouldn't want this one, trust me. It was.
Is that why I'm waiting so long? You're fucking hogging up. Give it me therapist, Jack. So, last question is, if you could go back to like your younger self and give some advice on sort of mental health and living like without misery, what would your advice be?
My advice to my younger self would be to not roll your eyes when people say that exercise is good for mental health. Because somebody would be like, have you tried running? And I'd be like, have you tried fucking off? And actually then every time, like right now, I've started going to the gym again because I've like been sat writing a book, so I've just eaten copious amounts of chicken selects. So like now I'm sort of going back into it, and I'm like, wow, it does make me feel great after. Like, genuinely, that has really helped. I think sort of like being a little bit more, I don't know, like, I definitely think there's some times whereby you can... It's quite a hard question.
Yeah,
and
sorry.
I did get told this question before the recording.
Which is really secretly bad prepped you.
I'd probably tell my younger self as well to stop worrying so much about things. I think, you know, this is something that through my sort of stuff at Calm, volunteering and speaking to other like young people who've been bereaved quite early on, you get almost, you develop this worst case scenario syndrome, and it's something I speak about a lot sort of at the top of this book, because I think it puts in context the sort of person I am, because I think that we all have one friend that we're a bit worried about, and I have both had that friend and been that friend. And I think when I have been that friend, it has very much been because when you lose someone early on in life and it's not the right order necessarily that you should or is supposed to happen, you kind of go, okay, well, actually, anything horrendous can happen at any given moment. And I think I lived pretty much from about 15, from when my dad died, to about 24. Genuinely, I mean, I didn't go on holiday until last year. It's like the first time that I'd actually gone away. And that's sad because I didn't go on any, like, lads' holidays. Or gay lads' holidays, or girls' holidays. Quite frankly, I did none of the three options available.
I just had a vision of a gay lads' holiday, and I want in.
Even then, I'd go on a gay lads' holiday, and I'd make sure I was the only gay lad on it. Be like, come on, let's get all the 20 straight best mates I've got. But worst case scenario syndrome sort of really made me just be like, well, if I go away, then my mum's going to die, or this person's going to die, or... And it really makes you sort of live your life in this very stinted, scared because you'll ever get hurt way. And I think that's really dogged my early 20s. And it's really made me a very angry person. There's definitely times, and it's really been in the last year since having that bad spout of anxiety, that I've really learned to look at that. Because the worst case scenario syndrome worked completely in a good way, made me very ambitious, made me be like, I'm going to achieve what I want to achieve. But then it also completely stunted me, prevented me from ever sort of trusting anybody in a relationship, prevented me from really like feeling just like carefree, feeling like, oh yeah, actually, like, life isn't going to throw like a million different things. And it totally makes sense why that happened, because, you know, my dad died very suddenly at 15, and for a good year I was really worried about Ollie's mental health, and I didn't really speak to him that much. And then I spoke to him about 10 days before you know, he died. And you know, you have that constant worry when you know somebody has got a really bad illness, that, you know, that they might do something one day, or that, you know, it might happen. And in my case, it did. And that is shit. And it's like, will always be shit. And the most important thing I can do is remember how amazing he was. And but being bereaved by that leaves you with a slight symptom of being like, well, it could happen at any time, and it did happen. And I remember my mum being like, well, you know, I'm sure he's going to be fine, and being like, well, actually, he wasn't. And, you know, that's not my mum's fault for saying that. Everyone's mum's going to be like, it's going to be fine. But like, it, in that case, it really wasn't. The worst case scenario did happen. And to try to not be permanently damaged by that is hard, but I think it's important, because Ollie would want me to go on the lads' holiday and the gay lads' holiday and the girls' holiday to wingman him. Like, yeah. Do you know what I mean? So
he wouldn't want you like stop living your life.
Completely. Yeah. And he also wouldn't want me to be constantly talking about suicide and sad shit all the time, which is why, like, you know, outside of the book, I'm trying to write just pure stand-up and just jokes and stuff that isn't about it at all, because that's as important. So yeah, I'd probably tell myself to just be a little bit like carefree more and not worry about it, because if the worst case scenario happens, you'll deal with it. And I'm quite lucky that, I think we all are lucky that things like this are existing, conversations like this are being had. And whilst sometimes I get annoyed where the mental health conversation is going, there's always going to be something that does actually genuinely mean something and does actually help people. So yeah.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Damn. Lovely. Thank you so
much.
Thanks, crew.
No, our pleasure entirely.
We hope you can take something from this podcast away with you in your day-to-day life. Whatever situation you're in, you're not by yourself. We can share our stories, share our experiences, we can help each other know that things do get better.
All the money that we make from adverts on this podcast goes directly to Calm. However, if you've got some extra money, I don't know your financial situation, you can go to uktv.co.uk/day/calm. And there's a big red button on there where you can donate some extra money to Calm if you want to. They are an incredible charity that do some amazing work. So any extra money you have, that would be grand. I'm still in the field, by the way, recording this outro. Lost the original outro on my laptop, so doing this one here. It's hard old life, isn't it? So if you could just... I'll probably cut all this bit out, to be honest. If you could rate, review, like, subscribe, tell your friends about the podcast. The more people that listen, the more money that goes to Calm, which is a nice thing to do, isn't it? That's it, really. Thanks to Lauren, obviously. Brilliant. Thanks to Dave for letting us make this silly podcast. Thanks to Calm for doing all the amazing work they're doing. Thanks to Alex Feldman, who edited the interview this week. And, thanks to you, I guess, for listening, because otherwise it's just two comedian and a comedy writer sat in a booth annoying famous people. That's brilliant. Thank you so much. And tune in next week, where I will definitely release one and won't oversleep. All right. Bye, 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 bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Would you give your mum, dad, aunt, or that uncle who hugged your partner a little too long free access to your phone?
Oh, no! Oh, my God, it's a really long video. Ew!
In Dave's brand new YouTube original, Get Off My Phone, we've got 6 comedians to give their phones over to a relative with total freedom to read messages, DMs, photos, and browser history.
Where's your search history?
Sorry?
What to do, tips for relief.
The rules are simple. Their relative can read anything they want and even make calls from the comedian's phone.
What is this? What is...
I don't want this one.
That looks really bad.
Starring Tanya Moore, Anya Magliano, Finlay Christie, Travis J with his mum Angie Lamar, Hayley Morris, Grace Campbell and dad Alistair Campbell.
Slightly sexually compromising people.
Divulging their deepest digital secrets.
What the hell is happening?
Get Off My Phone, a Dave YouTube original. Available now on Dave's YouTube channel.